For decades, when it comes to environmentalism, to saving the planet, the global movement has been virtually synonymous with curbing our carbon emissions, achieving CO2 neutrality, basically keeping the fossil fuels in the ground. But this past lockdown blighted year, I think, we've all come to appreciate the nature on our doorstep just a little bit more than we used to. Perhaps that's why protecting our natural areas and biodiversity seem to be increasingly on the political and news agendas around the world. That and the fact that it seems likely it was, of course, precisely man's encroachment on the natural world that gave us the gift of COVID. We've teamed up with the Nordic Council of Ministers for 5 special editions of the Foreign Desk Explainer, delving deeper into topics of global importance from the region: green transport, education, cultural collaboration, political cooperation, and the subject of this episode, biodiversity and protecting nature. What happens when achieving CO2 targets comes into direct conflict with nature? Can the industrial agriculture we need to feed ourselves coexist with increasing efforts to preserve and expand wild landscapes? And how can you make your back garden more biodiverse? I'm Michael Booth, and this is the Foreign Desk Explainer.
I think the biodiversity crisis should be mentioned almost every time the climate crisis is mentioned.
It's really ingrained in the Sami culture that we should not leave the mark on the nature.
We have a historical agreement in Denmark to protect our nature better.
That was the Danish Environment Minister, Lea Wermelin. She's in a battle with the powerful agricultural lobby there, but for now, things do seem to be swinging nature's way, as we'll hear later in the programme. The Nordic region might not seem all that diverse in terms of flora or fauna, at least not compared to, say, a tropical rainforest. But in Denmark alone, over 4,000 species of plants, animals, insects and birds are said to be at risk of being lost. I didn't even know there were 4,000 species of anything in Denmark. Clearly, it's time to act. My name is Michael Booth. I'm Monocles Man in Denmark and the author of a book about the Nordic region, The Almost Nearly Perfect People. For this special edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers, we're going to be coming at this from several angles, talking to a scientist who's working to ensure biodiversity in the distant future, a biologist at war with invasive species, but first, to the very northernmost part of the Nordic region, to Sapmi, the homeland of the Sami, the indigenous people of northern Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia. Recently, there's been a conflict there between the Sami reindeer herders of Nordland and a proposed wind turbine park at Eyfjall, which would be one of the largest in the country. The herders took the project to court earlier this year to appeal a decision against them. It's a tricky one, right? From an environmental point of view, wind turbines are good, sustainable clean energy and all that, but windmills are not entirely without consequence. In this case, according to the herders, they're highly disturbing to the reindeer, threatening a way of life which can be traced back many centuries. As I found out when I spoke down the line to Sami Council Arctic and Environmental Unit spokesman Lasse Bjørn.
The reindeers are afraid of being close to the windmills. They can't exist right next to each other. And when we're getting more and more of these windmill parks, in addition to all the other new roads, new cabins, so on, this makes it really hard to continue living the way of life that people have, working with reindeer husbandry, as they have done for hundreds of years. And everyone is saying that we have good causes. The windmill park is important for the green shift, as we say in Norway. And the tourism is important for the jobs, for the people. But everyone is taking small amounts of space and no one is looking at the whole picture and what is left for the reindeer herders. It's really ingrained in the Sami culture that we should not leave the mark on the nature. You have stories of people who are walking different paths every time they go up a mountain because they don't want their footsteps to be seen in the mountains, for example. And also the culture of reusing and reducing, instead of always when we talk about the green shift, we talk about needing more energy, we need more wind turbines, we need more hydroelectric power, because we're going to need a lot to move all of the fossil fuels over to renewable sources. But I think the Sami culture can teach us that we don't always need more of it. We can reduce, we can use the resources we have better. Reindeers are part of the biodiversity in the area. Lots of different species are used to the reindeers being them. They are used that they are eating the plants. And I can tell you that it will be a big issue for the plants and the other animals living around, because they are used to that reindeer herding and have been for thousands of years.
Lasse Bjørn has been working on several projects aimed at giving the Sami more of a voice when it comes to decisions regarding nature preservation and biodiversity in Sápmi, the Sami homeland, including one which involves the children of the reindeer herding community reporting back on what's been happening in the natural environment where they live.
One of the projects that we've been looking into is from the National Center for Reindeer Husbandry. School students have been gathering information from their reindeer herding societies, from their families, about what is changing, what is different in the reindeer husbandry community. And last winter, there were quite a few food crises in the reindeer herding community. And through this research, they got data on much earlier on how large of a problem it actually was. And it's been used as like an early warning system on changes in nature. The reindeer herders are people who are a lot out in nature. They see the changes much earlier than people living in cities, for example. We know that the climate is changing faster in the Arctic, and having people on the ground seeing all the changes that report on them will be important to understand climate change and also to understand its effect on biodiversity.
What are some of the other issues affecting the reindeer herders?
Some issues that are affecting the reindeer herders, for example, is both the intrusion of new species, of wolves, of animals. This is part because of climate change, but also part because of the encroachment of nature from human activity. When the areas the reindeers can live on become smaller and smaller, it's the same area where wild animals also can live. That means the problems with bears, eagles, and so on becomes much larger than it needed to be, because all of them are on the same place. Also, we've seen examples of rivers not freezing at the time it should, meaning that the reindeers can't move the way they normally have been doing. They can't cross waters, can't get to their traditional winter fields. So in a way, we are losing our land to stop a climate change that the indigenous people, in a way, is not responsible for.
That was Lasse Bjørn, spokesman for the Sami Council's Arctic and Environmental Unit. Later this year, COVID allowing, 196 nations will meet for COP15 in Kunming, China, hopefully to adopt a new UN Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD. In the run-up to that, the Nordic countries have been inviting younger citizens to get involved in the discussion about protecting nature, resulting in a Nordic youth delegation which plans to present its demands to the convention. And they're going to travel there halfway around the world, by train, of course. In Copenhagen, I met up with one of the Danish students who's hoping to be among them.
My name is Tine Sille Svensson, and I'm studying right now at the University of Copenhagen, studying a master in biology. And I'm involved with this project of youth engagement in the biodiversity crisis, started by the Nordic Council and the Nordic Council of Ministers. First of all, we were to advise Nordic Council in how to engage the youth, and now we also, or there's been creating a group, a network of Nordic youth for biodiversity, creating workshops, first of all, to inform youth of the biodiversity and the crisis, and also how the climate crisis and biodiversity crisis play together, and help them to create some kind of statement papers or demands to their respective national governments.
And you're also going to be taking some of your results or some of your petitions to China to the next COP meeting, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So now, after there's been these national workshops, right now actually we're trying to gather all the voices of the Nordic youth to create some kind of position paper that will be taken to the CBD negotiations in China, hopefully during the fall 2021.
That's, and you're going to travel there by train. How many of you?
The global network, GIBN, Global Youth Biodiversity Network, yes, had arranged this train trip. They really planned it to be a large train with a lot of youth from all over the world, actually, that would be able to join from someplace in Europe and take the train and invite politicians or decision makers and journalists doing the way to create an event through the whole week traveling to China.
From a global perspective, we often hear about biodiversity in crisis in rainforests and tropical zones where there is more greater levels of biodiversity. What's the issue in the Nordic region?
The challenges are also that we face less biodiversity in our everyday life. And even though we have it in these regions, we're not aware of it. And for example, a country as Denmark is one of the countries in the world that have least natural areas. We are not aware of what biodiversity we could have. I think all of the Nordic regions have been quite bad at reaching the European goal for conserving biodiversity. Denmark is one of the countries that have not done enough to save these Natura 2000 areas. So I think, no, the government is not doing enough. But it's certainly on the agenda now, which is good. I think the biodiversity crisis should be mentioned almost every time the climate crisis is mentioned.
Why is that? Why is it so important?
Because the biodiversity crisis focuses on what nature, of course, is it in itself, but also what it delivers us as services, the ecosystem services. So it provides us with the nutrition, for example, of all the plants we eat is biodiversity. And also the water we drink is clean because of ecosystem services that is also interacting with the climate. For example, forest, you can't change an area without changing the biodiversity and therefore also the climate, because the forest will affect the weather system.
Now, wolves in Denmark is quite a hot topic just this week, actually, because mysteriously, a lot of the wolves that have been reintroduced to the wild in Denmark have died, have disappeared. The implication being it's farmers shooting them and they're not allowed to, but they are.
Now, I can only speak of, maybe the youth that I speak with. Most of them would also speak for a wilder Denmark.
Pro-wolf.
Pro-wolf, yeah. But also many of the youth I'm talking with is living, for example, in Copenhagen. So that's a city, maybe not thinking of how it would affect them if they were a farmer or had children in those regions.
I mean, do you have sympathy for the farmers?
Yeah, I can see that there is a problem, definitely. And I could also see if I had children in those areas that I would probably be nervous. But also in Denmark, we were used to not being nervous of anything. So, and not having any complications with nature or wild climate extremes or something. So we really skånel, really
protected.
Yeah, quite protected.
Cosseted, yeah.
Yeah. So I think nature values is an interesting discussion.
What do you mean by that, nature values?
Well, nature values of how if nature have a value in itself or has a value in itself, and if we should preserve it because it has a right to exist. So for example, if rivers should be, some rivers now in, I think it's New Zealand and Bangladesh now have rights of its own, and maybe that should be
legal rights.
Yeah, and maybe we should have that to more types of nature, to forests or nature parks or reservations.
That was Tina Svensson of the Nordic Youth Delegation on Biodiversity. She mentioned that Denmark hasn't done enough to preserve what nature it has left after a century and a half of industrial agriculture. Recently, for instance, there's been some news about the worryingly high pollution levels of the country's groundwater from agricultural pesticides and fertilisers. But as I discovered when I met the Danish Environment Minister, Lea Wermelin, in a rather noisy park close to her office in central Copenhagen, that may now finally be changing.
We have a historical agreement in Denmark to protect our nature better. It's a promise that we made before the election. We've been elected on a green mandate and now we have the agreement in place. But of course we need to make it into reality, and that's what we're working on now, to set aside forests and to establish new nature national parks in Denmark. What we learned is that there's a very big consensus on making nature, giving it more space in Denmark and making room for a more wild nature in Denmark, where we've been accustomed to maybe a more cultivated nature as of up to now.
Now, Danish water, drinking water, has been in the news here recently. What's the nature of the threat to the drinking water in Denmark and what can be done about it?
Due to historical uses of pesticides, we've seen some examples of how we find more and more examples of pesticides in the water. And we need to make sure that we protect our groundwater for the coming and future generations as well. So, for instance, more forests in Denmark, that will be good to put it where we need to protect our groundwater as well. So, I mean, I'm very hopeful in terms of the green mandate that we are standing on. on as a government, but we are in a nature crisis as well as a climate crisis.
These are all great intentions, but in Denmark, as you say, has a long history of being an industrial agriculture country, and there's always pushback from the very powerful agriculture lobby here. How do you fight back against that, and what are the economic factors working against what you want to do? I mean, you want to create 15 new nature parks, for example, and wild forests. The farmers aren't going to give up that easily, are they?
On the last finance bill, we set aside a historical amount for nature, which will help us to increase the number of acres for set aside forests, but also these new national parks as well. So, I mean, that's a huge step forward to protecting nature in Denmark, but it's not where we're going to stop. So, right now, we are negotiating with all of Parliament in terms of how we can green our agricultural sector, also with inputs from the agricultural sector itself, because if we want to reach our goals in terms of climate and nature, we need everyone to take part and do their part in this travel that we're all on.
So globally, and also in Denmark, the big sexy environmental topic has, of course, been carbon reduction. And also in Denmark as well, with the ambitious targets to reduce by 70% by 2030. Biodiversity and protecting nature is kind of a little bit in the shadow of that. How are you combating that kind of the green image of Denmark as the windmills and the carbon cutting and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, I've been asked that question a lot of times because people are afraid that climate would somehow overshadow the whole role of protecting nature better. But I see it the other way around, that climate rising on the international agenda as well is also putting a focus on nature. So my hope is that we, in the end of 2021, that we will get the agreement on nature that we did with the Paris Agreement for climate. So I think that it can actually help us push the agenda forward so that we can, for instance, protect 30% nature on land and on sea that we are working on from the Danish side together with a lot of other countries.
From a Nordic perspective, which Nordic countries are doing this well?
Well, I think that the Nordic countries, I mean, we're like brothers and sisters in our countries, and we're working very hard on, for instance, marine plastic litter, which ends up in our sea, and that's where we're working very closely together, and hopefully by working together, our impact will also be bigger.
But in this new biodiversity nature pack, there's 888 million kroner, which is about £1 billion, but only, I think, 10 million kroner for the seas.
Well, that's because it's not an agreement that will take us the whole way in terms of the sea. We are working both on looking at protected areas, for instance. It's not part of that agreement. And we're working also with the improvement on our seas, on our waters, in terms of the agricultural impact. So, I mean, we cannot stand on this agreement alone, but it's a historical agreement for Denmark because it focuses narrowly on how to protect areas where all of the species that you mentioned before, which are threatened now, that most of them live in our forests. So we need to stop the forest production in those areas.
That was Danish Environment Minister Lea Wermelin. We were talking about biodiversity in nature, but what about biodiversity in our backyards? Like many people lucky enough to have a garden, I've spent a lot more time than usual pondering horticultural issues this past lockdown-plagued year. Among those issues has been my ongoing battle with Japanese knotweed. I'm usually a fan of anything Japanese, but they're knotweed. Really, they can keep it. It's just one invasive plant species which is threatening biodiversity in people's back gardens everywhere, including Sweden, as Monocle's Stockholm correspondent Liv Lewicznik discovered.
My name is Ulf Nilsson. I work at the Swedish Leisure Garden Association. So we are about 70,000 members in Sweden. They're really keen gardeners, all of them. More people have time for being out in the gardens and they want to grow new things, and they have new questions. So we really see a bigger interest.
So let's talk about some of the issues when it comes to invasive species in Sweden.
It's first during the last like 5, 6, 7 years, it's been starting to be an issue. And I think it's really taking up speed now the last 2 years. they are moved from their natural settings, so they don't really have any enemies when they come here to a new place to grow. So they haven't any competition. Perhaps they're really good at starting and growing very quickly, and they will then compete with the natural fauna and flora. So they're actually making the biodiversity less diverse, or the nature less diverse.
And where do they come from? How do they get here?
When it comes to the invasive alien plants, they very often come from our gardens. We like new things, new plants, new colors, and we want the ones that are quite extraordinary in size, and we also want plants that are really easy to grow. I mean, that quickly fill their place in the garden. The problem is when these species actually go over the fence and into the nature, and then compete with our small, perhaps rare flora and fauna. The most important advice we have is how to treat the plant. When you dug it up, you see this is an invasive alien species. What do you do then? Because, unfortunately, it's quite common that people actually dump plants in the forest. And that's the number one reason for these species actually spreading in our nature. The number one on the list that you should actually be very, very aware of and avoid, it's Japanese knotweed. And that's a big problem. We start to see the spread, and I actually think it starts to spread even more when the authorities start to talk about these species, because people want to get rid of the Japanese knotweed. Then they start to dig it up from the gardens, and they put it on trailers going to the recycling plants. And then they shake it off during the way on the road. So you actually see it more and more in south of Sweden now, where it's growing in the ditches. The origin of this plant is from Japan, where it grows at the volcano slopes. So it actually can tolerate high temperatures, very harsh conditions, high salt concentration in the soil. So it's a really competitive plant that very quickly can fill a gap in your garden.
And how are you getting rid of it then? It sounds like almost an impossible task.
More or less. We are actually having discussion with authorities in Sweden what they should do and not do. And the problem is when we look at the scientific results, from the UK, the only thing that works quite okay is herbicides, chemical treatment. And we have worked now very hard in Sweden for 20 years to get rid of herbicides and pesticides from our gardens, home gardens. So it's very difficult what to do, actually.
The trend in Sweden when it comes to protecting nature and biodiversity, what do you see there?
The Swedish Leisure Garden Association have a project now, together with wildlife associations, which we call the Richer Garden. And it's about how to improve and increase the biodiversity in your own home garden. Because that's a thing you actually can do quite easily. And you can also see a change, a positive change. We don't save the old trees, the dead trees. And that's something you actually could do a big difference in your own garden. The more complex, the more different species you have in an area, the more insects you can have, the more birds. The last year we have seen a lot of articles about the Swedish forestry and the problem with the Swedish forestry. So hopefully we will see some change. People actually start to getting more and more concerned about biodiversity and the loss of biodiversity in Sweden. So I think we'll have much more discussion about how to take care of our forests. And also you're not just looking at the economic around the forest plantations, and also I think more of the other values that the forests are producing.
Staying in Sweden, but instead of the plants they want to get rid of, we're going to look at the ones they want to keep for the future. In Alnarp, just outside of Malmö in the south of the country, our correspondent Richard Orange went along to the HQ of NordGen, the Nordic Genetic Resource Centre. You may have heard of NordGen's amazing seed bank deep in a mountainside in Svalbard in the Norwegian Arctic. But as Richard found out, in Alnarp, the work has a more dynamic focus.
My name is Lise Løkke Steffensen, and I am the executive director of the Nordic Genetic Resources Center, also called NordGen. And in here we have some of the potatoes. Some of the potatoes that we have here actually were brought, for instance, to Finland under some of the wars. Finnish soldiers, they actually found some potatoes in Russia and they brought them back. And then some of them are dated back in the 1700s, 1800 and have a history there.
Outside the cauldron holding the Nordic potato collection, there's a hall of 87 humming back-to-back freezers.
In here we have some of the seed samples that we store here in the gene bank. We have around 35,000 different seed samples. We store them in here in freezers, minus 18 degrees Celsius, because then we know that it will store for a very long time. Now we are walking up to the greenhouse and the gardens of Nordjyn. And it's here where we regenerate the seeds when they need that, or multiply them if we have too few seeds. And we have around 1,200 different varieties.
Why is it important to preserve the biodiversity from the Nordic countries?
First of all, biodiversity is very, very important. It's so integrated in our daily life that we couldn't live without plants. They are the fundamentals for human life. And then we need resilient systems. We see that with the corona crisis right now. We see actually how fragile we are. And we need to have a broad base of genetic resources, first of all, to make our ecosystems resilient, but also for us to give us options. When we've lost the genetic resources, they're lost forever.
Is there a sort of scarcity of biodiversity in the Nordics because the climate has been harsher?
It's so scarce and it's so fragile. We are in the circumpolar area, meaning that we have very long summer days. And in many places, it's also light during the night. You don't have this night factor. And we have a short growing season.
Does that mean that there are fewer varieties of plant in this region than in, say, the tropics?
Yes. First of all, there is that. There are many things you can't grow unless you grow them in greenhouses. Seeds that grow perfectly in Italy, they will simply die of stress if we plant them out here in the north of Sweden or Norway. So we don't have that many choices. And so that's why we should take extra care of the choices that we possibly have.
With climate change making it hotter across Sweden and also drier sometimes, there was a terrible drought in Sweden a few years ago. How can Nordjyn help with that?
That's true, and I think that was a wake-up call that we had this really dry year. I think it was of 2018, where many farmers faced that they didn't have enough feed for their animals, and those who were just producing cereals, they lost half or even more of their harvest. But what we also saw was that there were some farmers that actually had grown some of their cereals from here. And one of them, it's called Ølands wheat. And it was abandoned many years ago because it grows 2 meter high and it's very difficult to harvest. But it turned out that it grew really nicely well. And why? Because it might be 2 meter high, but it had 2 meter long roots.
It's not just wheat. Nordjyn looks for hardy Nordic varieties of all sorts of plants.
We have tried to grow different varieties of peas as far north as we absolutely could to see, okay, if we have a very short season, can we actually grow a protein crop? And it actually turned out that some of the old varieties, they were quite growing well. Although it was snowing, it was still growing, which is incredible.
Back at Nordjyn's offices, Maria Ulfsa is applying a barcode scanner to seeds that are about to make the trip to the Arctic.
This box will go to Svalbard, and it's full, and now I inventory it and extra check that it's correct.
When you're safeguarding the Nordic region's heritage of wheat, grasses, peas, and yes, 18th century potatoes, the work never ends.
That was Richard Orange at the Nordic Genetic Resource Centre HQ just outside of Malmö, Sweden. That's all for this week's special episode of the Foreign Desk Explainer. Listen out for more of these editions, produced by me, Michael Booth, in association with the Nordic Council of Ministers. It was edited by the team at Monocle 24 in London. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.